Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Someone who, from growing up as a socially marginalised Pentecostal pastor's son in communist Yugoslavia, is today distinguished Henry B. Wright Professor of Theology at Yale Divinity School. I'm talking about Miroslav Volf, who's in Australia at the moment and a guest of various conferences around town, and amidst his busy schedule found time to seek us here on Sunday night. Miroslav Volf, welcome to Sunday night.
Thank you very much.
I was struck by something else in your brief bio, that you're a champion of religious reconciliation, and in a moment marked either by divine providence or supreme irony, on the morning of 9/11/2001, at 8:34 in the morning, as the first plane hit the World Trade Center, you happened to be finishing a keynote address at the International Prayer Breakfast of the United Nations. There is theory and practice colliding.
Yeah, and topic of my speech was reconciliation. What I also did, and I had absolutely no idea, of course, what's going to happen, is I was quoting a poem by famous Jewish poet about Holocaust. Poem is called Death Fugue, and it starts, "Black milk of daybreak, we drink it, we drink." And it has a line in it, "We dig a grave up in the air, there you won't lie too cramped." And it was about, of course, gas chambers and the graves of people up in the air. And there, as I was finishing, people were going up in the grave as a result of exact opposite of what reconciliation signifies.
How quickly did what happened that morning begin to impact on you, both physically and intellectually?
It took us a while to process what's happening. It took us a while to leave then New York City. And I think as I was observing the exodus by foot of people through the streets of New York, and then you realized after a few hours it was a ghost city. And we were talking together, and so you could see this immense fear descending upon the city. Impact started already there.
It must have struck you, though, for a moment, that you had to reflect, are my words empty vessels here?
Yeah, and sometimes I think what you experience is, especially if you are in the midst of conflict, and that talk of reconciliation rings very hollow. People don't want to hear about reconciliation. At that moment, when the streets were being emptied, you could just sense the surge of anger. So not only, in a sense, did I miss because these two planes have hit the Twin Towers.
Yes, this represents a refutation of everything you've been talking about.
Absolutely, and then people too who are leaving New York, they're full of rage. So what am I doing talking about reconciliation? You know, I've realized back in Yugoslavia, while I was in Yugoslavia, that actually times of reconcilers aren't those times. It's before conflict and after conflict. In the conflict itself, the focus narrows, world becomes black and white, tensions become very strong. So to ask somebody who is in the midst of conflict to step back, see things from the perspective of the other, start building bridge, they'd rather fire a bullet than build a bridge.
Some have also offered the observation that paradoxically that day, that moment, marked a key transitional point when religion returned to the public square.
Well, I think what would be correct to say is that not that religion returned to the public square, but that the awareness of religion, which already always was on the public square, has come to the consciousness, especially of the Western world. But you had a sense already, say, from the 60s, as the wave of decolonization and democratization started in the world, increasingly, especially then after the demise of the bipolar world, increasingly religion was not just alive as it always was, but as the world was democratizing, it became also politically assertive. That's basically a very simple equation. if you embrace democracy and a religious person, you're going to bring your convictions into the public square.
There was a sense, though, in Western intelligentsia particularly, that religion would eventually fade away, that it was becoming less relevant as a motivating force.
Yeah, I mean, it's still there, this sense that religion is fading away, or sometimes people would describe what one sees now, a religious resurgence, as kind of last gasps of unreason, kind of flurry just before religion's demise. I don't think anything indicates that would be the case. I think all the indicators, sociological studies, say that in the foreseeable future, the world is going to grow more religious rather than less, and more religious in absolute, not just in absolute, but in relative terms. Now, I'm not making that as a kind of valuative judgment, nor am I, as a religious person, saying this would be the note of triumph. It's an ambivalent thing, not necessarily a positive thing, but it is the reality with which we have to contend, and any hopes that the world would secularize are just empty ideology.
It was thrown into stark relief by that now famous or infamous foreign affairs article, The Clash of Civilizations, that okay, the political substrate actually has to be seen in terms that are different, and it relates to civilizational things, and religious traditions are foundational in this.
Yeah, I think that's one aspect of one significant aspect. I think Huntington stressed more differences than he did similarities and overlaps. And I think it's important to note both that religious shape social spaces, cultures, and broadly whole civilizations, but religions also bind. Bind people also across the religious lines, especially if you don't simply zero in on the boundaries, but if you look at the cores. And if you look at the cores, then you see significant overlaps.
It depends whether you take an inclusive or an exclusive view of your religious tradition, and that's something I'd like to explore with you a little later on in this discussion. But there is another way in which that experience of 9/11 is resonant of much of your life experience. You grew up as a Pentecostal pastor's son in communist Yugoslavia. You go through the breakup of communism, the end of ideology in that sense, but then you see a society destroyed by religious division, or divisions that were in part religious. You see Muslim, Orthodox, and Catholic elements in those terrible fractures.
Right. I think that's quite correct to say that it was partly religiously motivated and religiously legitimized. I don't think it would be correct to say that the war in former Yugoslavia, or rather I should say wars in former Yugoslavia, were religious wars in any sense. Religion served as markers of identity. And then pretty soon you have alignment between political elites and powers and religion. And when you have a religion as a marker of identity and associated with powers that be, all the other reasons for conflict that political communities might have end up getting a kind of a religious sheen to them. They end up being baptized and religion ends up being implicated more of a servant of the conflict than a really active, significant cause.
In the Balkans crisis, more than once, people dredged down to the Reformation, to the wars of the 16th century, to the Muslims at the gates of Vienna. Everything played to religious chords.
Yeah, I think that's exactly religious as markers of identity. And then once you have them as a religious as markers of identity, then you can play them up. You know, very, very interesting example are for instance, Yugoslavia and Bosnian Muslims. Now, most of them were secularized. Right, so they were called Muslims, and as ethnic identity, not so much as religious belonging, because only some 13% of them were actually religious Muslims. They end up being not just radicalized, but turned more religious as a result of war rather than being religious. So a marker of identity was then filled in by radical commitments to a particular religion in opposition to attack from the outside. It's a kind of interesting way in which religion plays a role.
You've been thinking and writing about this for a number of years now, but I'd like to concentrate for a moment on your experience growing up in a communist Yugoslavia that begins to disintegrate, but as part of a subset that is already marginalized as a Pentecostal pastor's son.
Yeah, yeah. No, I was a Pentecostal pastor's son, and I was the only kind of openly associated kid with religion.
I mean, it's tough enough to be Protestant, but a subset of Protestantism, and Pentecostalism is really on the margins.
You know, some of the most painful experiences beginning of the school year. We had to each stand up, not only give our names, of course, but names of our parents. And then what's your father's profession? My father is a minister. What's a minister? We know what the priest is. That's bad. It's like Protestant, but, you know, and that's also already I'm sliding down. Now, where does your father work? My father works in Christ's Pentecostal Church of Yugoslavia. Christ F what church? Now I have to spell. Word Pentecostal in front of the whole class. I'm 10 years old. I have to spell Pentecostal in front of the whole class, and I am red in my face, and I'm praying for the earth to open up and swallow me in cruel mercy. You know, that's partly what it was.
It's all right. I was a junior soldier in the Salvation Army. I can cheer.
I see. Yeah, yeah.
What did it do to you? Do you now trace back and say that probably goes to some way explaining why I am the person I am today and what shapes my interests?
You know, I think more than of course some of these experiences shape who I am. A kind of realization and ability to then live and negotiate. Living in a marginal situation and kind of discovery then later on the benefits of marginality, right? But I think what shaped me more profoundly is family upbringing. My father was on a death march immediately after World War II. He saw out of 1,000, 700 of his fellow inmates killed along the road, and then he became a laborer in a labor camp and was skin and bones, ready to die, and furious, absolutely furious at God. And I won't go into the story necessarily here, maybe it's too long, but somehow he discovered love of God in the midst of what is hell. And in this discovery, puzzling discovery that became mediated to a person who was extraordinarily generous to my father, that discovery changed the whole situation. Nothing changed, and yet everything changed for him. And I think it's formed what one might describe a kind of a non-reactive stance toward the communists, toward those on the outside. I mean, it's in the hell that God found him. God of love that found him. So the stance now is not simply opposition to this awful thing that he had. Stance is also a kind of differentiated attitude where love of God is dominant, and whatever is outside, it's you relate to it on the basis of the heart of your experience. Now, that stance of my father, without me knowing until quite a bit later, actually shaped what I have done then in the books on reconciliation.
That's profoundly the heart of the Christian mystery.
Absolutely.
Yet you yourself took a while to come to terms with that. You talk about walking away from Christianity for some time.
Yeah. You know, I think my walking away from it was more partly kind of teenage years, too impressed with some of the stuff we were learning in school, but I think more basically, it's a kind of sense that the faith that I was being given was very opposite of hypocritical, but it was too heavy burden to carry. It's almost like you're handed something beautiful, but it made on you as on me as a kid.
Did you make a distinction between the faith you saw lived in your father and the burden of doctrine and organization that the church represented? Was that?
You know, obviously we knew a large institution that the church was, say Catholic, Orthodox, implicatedness of institutions in atrocities and violence, kind of problematic nature of institutions. And then I was a preacher's kid, right? I observed a small institution at work, and I saw all sorts of weird, crazy characters part of this thing. I saw also saints, and there's like this mixture of weirdos and saints and all together. together somehow, trying to struggling, undermining my father's work. Some of them, other ones, celebrating him. It was just a disorienting kind of a thing. But my parents were, I guess, in their lives, they were your regular Christians, run of the mill beliefs.
If you had to draw a line that said, what was the link that brought me back to Christianity, that brought me back to an informed faith, but a faith that nevertheless is quite profound and deeply held?
I think the link was simply that I pulled back, went on a trip with a group of Swedish young people as their translator. I was interested in girls, wasn't interested in what they were trying to do. They were kind of a group of folks who were having a vacation, but also doing some evangelistic work. I realized that faith isn't necessarily faith for old people. I realized that you don't have to bear this burden as heavily as I have managed that you can. But I think the content came from my parents, because it was a beautiful faith. It was lived with generosity. It was lived with a smile. My nanny, image of God that I still have, is the face of my nanny superimposed on the story of the prodigal son, father in the story of the prodigal son.
It's experiential at a very deep
absolutely.
Level.
Absolutely. I think it's a kinds of people that these people were, that ultimately kind of I relented to, in a sense. I opened myself up to it, or I was always already open, and I just didn't know it, and realized, wow, this is amazing life. And then it was a question, well, how do I, who I was, hormones raging left and right, propensities of all sorts, how do I kind of live into the beauty of this faith? And this has been actually the trajectory and journey of my life.
On Sunday night, our guest is Miroslav Volf, theologian, professor at Yale Divinity School, and somebody who takes an active interest in religion and public life, particularly these days over reconciliation, interfaith dialogue, intercommunal dialogue. Miroslav, let's talk theology for a moment. Theology is associated by most people's minds as the burden of the church, as is explaining the inexplicable and a bit of a waste of time. Yet you're somebody who says, no, through my experience growing up as a Pentecostal pastor's son, then progressing on to Fuller Seminary in the United States, the home seminary of American evangelicalism, and now on to Yale Divinity School, mainline Protestantism writ large, have said that, no, theology is critical in understanding our place in the world. Why?
Well, I think that because of faith, and in my case, the Christian faith, it orients one's life. But faith is, I think, at its very core, whatever else the faith is, Christian faith is, it gives you an account of who you are, the self. It gives an account of social relations, and it gives an account of the good. And then it situates this account in the larger interpretation of reality.
It's always about me in relation to the world, in relation to reality.
Yeah, and the reality's relationship to me, how I am related and how I am structured, not just in relationship to the visible, but how I am structured and indeed constituted by the relationship to me of the invisible. And in that sense, you know, you're right, that there are these mysteries at the very heart of the faith. And I don't think that one can simply, on rational grounds, persuade people to accept faith. But one can, I think, show why it is that something like the Christian faith makes sense, how it makes sense of our human experience, how it makes sense to believe in the invisible, to believe in God, and how then we are to live in the world today.
In the broadest sense, is it a quest for coherence?
It's quest for coherence, but for my perspective, so it's not, I put it this way. Some people think that religion is about explaining reality. There's a bit of explaining there too. I've just described it. Some people think that religion is about manipulating reality. And there's some of it, blessings or prayers or something like that. But if you take religion as simply explanatory, often people then think of it as a primitive science. And if you take religion simply as manipulative reality, then it ends up being primitive technology. But I think there
cargo is... Cargo cult. Give me the blessings from heaven.
Absolutely.
The golden calf.
Exactly. But I think at the heart of faith, at the heart of religion, certainly the heart of world faith, heart of Christian faith, is not so much, it's something more. It's account of the self in the sense of the purpose of our existence. A kind of explanation of why it is that human hearts are restless, why it is that we invest so much value in constantly satisfying our desires, and why does that thirst never satisfy? That's at the heart of faith.
And some people would say, but why introduce God into that?
That's very good.
Isn't that the quest of every intelligent, sensitive, thoughtful human being?
Oh, absolutely, it's a quest of every intelligent and sentient human being. Question, I think for me the question is, and again, I'm not trying to persuade necessarily or argue into, but for me the question is, are our desires structured in such a way that they can actually find fulfillment at the flat plane of everyday material reality? And my response to that would be that they are not. That's why we kind of insatiably look for the novelty, and searching in novelty, we are trying to search to something that actually cannot satisfy us at the level of created realities.
And for you, Christianity offers the best explanation, or the best totalizing is the wrong word, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think for me, the Christian faith, I think Jesus Christ, offers the best window into what that transcendent reality is, and in what ways does it bear upon our everyday lives. In what ways can our religious experience actually be a foundation of a truly flourishing human life?
A lot of people would find that hard to cop these days. They're in Australia and in the United States and in Britain and in Ireland. They're confronted by institutional clergy abuse and saying there's something wrong with both the individuals and the institutions which have allowed those individuals to flourish. Christianity doesn't have anything to offer here.
Yeah, I think Christianity often, throughout the history today, has been, I would put it, severely distorted. And especially when I think about sexual scandals, what's so incredible to me in some ways is a kind of the hypocrisy, unwillingness to admit to the wrong. Now, think of it this way. We, as human beings today, especially contemporary human beings, we're fascinating with the idea of authenticity. We want to be authentic, and yet, in today's world, we're very far from being authentic, right? Because we always have to package ourselves from the moment we get up to the moment we go to bed. We package, repackage ourselves, sell ourselves, edit our stories. We always live on the surface for somebody else, to impress somebody else and us through the eyes of others. We edit ourselves. And the great message of the Christian faith, which I think one of the most attractive things, is God is unconditional love. You're loved no matter what kind of socks you wear. You're loved no matter what kind of resume you have. You're loved for the sheer fact of your existence, and God finds delight in you. Now, to have an institution that represents this kind of God, unwilling to recognize the wrongs that have been committed, it just seems to me a completely absurd. Kind of putting a face which, you know, nobody's persuaded by it, and it goes, and it's contradictory to the very heart of the faith. Now, I'm attracted to this incredible God of the Christian faith, which is God of Jesus Christ.
It strikes a resonant chord in Australian literary tradition to love the individual good man, the good individual pastor, but to be dismissive of the institutional framework that surrounds them. And that burden of the institution is something that Christians today are having to come to terms with.
Yeah, I think institutions have this kind of dual side to them.
Yes, they're necessary to keep the faith alive.
They're necessary. Well, to not just keep faith alive. They're necessary to keep life alive. You get three persons together, people together doing the same thing. There's an institution for you, right? And it's a matter of the level of institutionalization that we have. So institutions are a part and parcel of human existence, but institutions also choke individuals. They put constraints, and sometimes they end up putting constraints that are utterly at odds with who human beings truly are. The man is not created for the Sabbath, but the Sabbath, or the other way around, right? Or the Sabbath was created for the man. Actually, I said it correctly, right? So you have Sabbath as an institution that, in a sense, was supposed to open up the space for human beings, suddenly become something that chokes human beings. That's the ambivalence of religion and other areas as well.
You've opened up one of the areas that you're interested in there, that is the way religion intersects with public life. And you've mentioned the Sabbath as an institution. Currently in Australia, there's a debate about the weekend. Are we not now in a 24/7 economy? Isn't the weekend irrelevant? Why should people be paid extra money for working on weekends? Institutional religion, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, all have something to say on this.
I think so. I think certainly Judaism and Christianity, I'm quite familiar with those too, a kind of sense that one doesn't live by bread alone, and therefore a sense that one doesn't live by work alone. So that rest, so that delight, so that joy isn't just a pause between the work, and it's not functionalized with regard to work, but it's actually a fundamental mode of human existence.
We are not simply homo economicus.
Absolutely not. I mean, Nietzsche had interesting things to say in Gay Science about this. You know, basically he says, you know, everywhere you turn, joy doesn't have a doesn't have reputation. It's completely functionalized to productivity in life. And I think discovery of joy would be immense contribution to contemporary societies. We've lost joy.
Churches seem to get disconnected over the last century or so from the public square. Is that part of their failure in the West? That evangelical churches went into putting souls in the heavenly lifeboat and not worrying about the world as it was, that in the Catholic Church was a great need to rethink, and they've been struggling with senses of identity and community and their place in the world for the past couple of hundred years. So it's been an internal discussion, and the public square has been vacated.
Yeah, I think it has been that internal discussion, but I think prior to that, in a sense, there was a sense of religion claiming saturating the public, totally the public space. Once you saturate, then you have people who think differently, they feel marginalized, and a kind of secular rebellion against religion is partly in response to saturating the public space by religion. Now, you had then secular reverse of that, so you have a kind of secular saturation of the space and exclusion of religion. And I think we are now at the point where we can find a kind of happy medium, where I think we can have a pluralistic democracy in which the voices both of secularists of various stripes and also of religious people of various stripes can have equal footing in the public square and hopefully develop a debate, a democratic debate around significant issues.
We're rapidly running out of time, but one final question that relates to this. Many people say, look, this is not only between religious people and secular people, it's between religious traditions, not just Catholics and Protestants, but between Christians and Muslims, that interfaith dialogue is critical. Some people would then say, oh, yes, look, we're all on different paths up the same mountain. And we all need to just be nice to each other and everything in the garden will be lovely. Some others, like Stephen Prothero at Boston University, wrote a book last year saying God is not one, that religions are about quite fundamentally different things. How then do you proceed?
I think I'm more on the side of Stephen Prothero there. But if they are maybe not fundamentally about different things, but they give alternative competing often accounts of who the self is, social relations and the good, with a claim to universality, with a claim to truth. And most religious people actually experience it in those terms. Now the question is, well, is it possible then to have a meaningful discussion? I think if religions make claims to truth, it's possible to have meaningful discussion. If religions are simply human beings emoting, then there's no discussion about this. And so actually I see in the claims to truth of various religions as a possibility of opening up the space in which you can have a rational discourse. Let me give you an illustration. I teach at Yale a course. It's called Life Worth Living. We study Buddha. We study Jesus. We study Moses. We study Muhammad, John Stuart Mill, and Nietzsche. And each one of them makes claims to truth. And what we are asking students...
And you don't relativize them?
Well, what we are asking students is to us, no. We are asking students to take claims to truth, take them seriously, put the conversation with one another, and put them in conversation with your life. So we ask the student...
And exercise judgment.
Absolutely. How would your life need to look differently if Buddha was correct? And so on for every one of them.
Miroslav Volf, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.